So I hope I have understood the topic correctly. Summary of chapter 9? Chapter 9. So your successively studying the chapters of Bhagavad Gita?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so you've just finished chapter 8?
Yes, ma'am.
So if I ask you some questions about chapter 8, you'll be able to answer them, right? Uh-oh. we'll make an easy one first. What's the title of chapter 8? What's the title of chapter 8? What's the title?
Attaining the Supreme.
Attaining the Supreme. Okay. Thank you. That was a good start. Oh, you can close your book now.
I didn't realize the closed book to add.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so now comes a very general question. One at a time, what are some of the main messages of chapter 8? Main messages, one at a time. What's one of the main messages of chapter 8 without looking at chapter 8? One of them. What's the main message of chapter 8? Yes.
Amarat 8 is because it's right in the middle. So it summarizes previous all chapters, and the final conclusion is going to, like, you have to surrender, and the devotional service is the only way out of this material misery. So.
Okay.
Excuse me.
I'll just add to Srila Prabhupada. I guess the key message that I got out of chapter 8 was to answer this question that Arjuna poses: How do you remember Krishna at the time of death? And most of the chapter focuses on the way you remember Krishna at the time of death is by practicing continuously. In Krishna consciousness, the way you just practice daily, so that it becomes part of your life, so that it's easy to remember Krishna at the time of death. It's not an effort or work to do that. So it's come very naturally.
Maharaj, just to continue from that, one message was that Krishna declares that if you remember me at the time of death, you will certainly attain it.
Okay. And then the means to remember Krishna at the time of death is by practicing remembering Krishna during life. And that's the process of devotional service. Okay, well, what does that say?
Without deviation, and to be fixed on Krishna.
Without deviation, one should always remember Krishna. And then? Good things will happen. Something will happen. You'll attain Krishna. You get out of the, as you said, the miseries of material existence. Any other? That's the main message. There's some discussion about what happens if you don't remember Krishna at the time of death. There's some of that discussion, right? What are some of the things what's the consequence if you don't remember Krishna? Well, there's this young man right in front of you. He wants to volunteer.
Rebirth.
And can you elaborate a little bit?
You're reborn. You don't achieve spiritual.
Right. And what do you achieve instead?
You achieve rebirth.
Yeah. And what kind of rebirth? What are the varieties of rebirth?
You achieve a lower form of rebirth.
Well, it depends on what your mind is fixed on at the time of death, right?
Yeah.
And lower is if your thoughts are lower, and higher is if your thoughts are higher, but still a rebirth. And what if your thoughts are higher, but you haven't yet thought of Krishna? Okay, well, what's that? What kind of birth is that? It's described in chapter 8. A heavenly planet, right?
Yeah.
Well, what happens if you go to the heavenly planets? Because you didn't remember Krishna, but you were a good person, a pious person, you went to the heavenly planets. What happens?
You it's easier to and you become more happy, it's easier to be happy there.
And then what happens?
You achieve Krishna.
Not necessarily. That's not what's described in chapter 8. What happens? Generally speaking, you exhaust your pious merits, your punya count is withdrawn to zero. So you're kicked out. You can't stay in the heavenly planets if your punya count is zero. And then what happens?
Come back
again. Start all over again. And descend into what kind of families? There's two options that are mentioned.
Srimatam.
Suchinam. Srimatam Gehe. Of Suchi. What does Suchi mean?
Pure.
Like clean. Suchi and Muchi. Clean and unclean. So one takes birth in a Brahmin's family. And from that position of a Brahmin's family, one can then continue in purifying one's existence. Or Srimatam, what's that? Wealthy family. So at least you don't have to worry about how you can exist. You can have abundance. And then if you're pious, you use that in the proper way and then continue in your devotional practice where you left off. But there's another alternative, even better than that Ferris wheel. What's better? Your next birth, you take birth in a devotee family, just continue in your devotional practice, like some of you guys. Just continuing in your devotional service where you left off. But once you understand that, then the next message is, hey, let me finish in this life so I don't have to do this again. Just complete my business in devotional service. Okay. So, since Bhagavad Gita, we've discussed about chapter 8 just in part to examine and see how well you've assimilated the message and also to get you involved. And then it's also to, because it's a conversation, the ninth chapter naturally follows the topics of the eighth chapter. So if the conclusion of chapter 8 is, what is it? Ananya Cheta Satatam. Always remember Krishna without fail. It takes you out of this Ferris wheel and into the spiritual realm. The cycle of birth and death is completed. And this feature of happiness and distress spoken about in the second chapter, pleasure and pain, light and dark, winter and summer, young and old. Birth and death, it's all history. You regain your position in the spiritual world. So that's the conclusion of chapter 8. One surpasses the path of light and darkness. Even beyond light is being situated in the kingdom of God. So that's very important. So that's where chapter 8 ends. So chapter 9 is... Krishna says, this is the most confidential knowledge of the entire Bhagavad Gita. Oh, better pay attention because it's very important. It's the Mahima section. Raja Vidya, Raja Guyam, Pavitram, Idam Uttamam, Pratyaksham, Avagamam, Dharmyam, Susukam, Kartam, Avyayam. If you can understand what that means, it's pay attention. Because it's the purest It gives direct perception of the self by realization. Not like, oh, there's something nice after this life, I hope. But it gives direct, you know, pratyaksha means like, you know, there's the wall, and I know on the other side of the wall there's a yard and there's a tree, but there's the window and I can directly see, there's the tree. There's a bird jumping around and wind blowing, and I can see it. Direct perception. And saying, we know that there's a soul, at least we believe that there's a soul, but this knowledge gives direct perception of the soul. Wow. And perception of Krishna, like double well. One can experience this personally. But, there's always a but. There's two conditions that are required in order to have that direct perception. One is not envious of Krishna. And the other is one is faithful. So we're going to hear something about what faith and what is envy. Because I'm going to make this little PowerPoint presentation and it's all going to be said. So faith and being non-envious. Everyone that has a material body, it's like a flag flapping in the wind that says, I've got envy. Because if I didn't have envy, I wouldn't have one of these. Or the other way around. Everyone that has one of these has envy. So we have to overcome that enviousness of Krishna. And then we can have a Krishna flag, and that's a spiritual body, spiritual form. So Krishna is going to describe the most confidential knowledge. Question. Confidential, more confidential, most confidential. What are those stages? What's confidential knowledge? Like if you say something to somebody, it's, don't tell anybody, keep this confidential. That's one kind of confidential. But this is, he's telling everybody. It's not that kind of confidential. It's still confidential. It's not that kind. Don't tell anybody kind. It's something that's very dear to you. Is very confidential. So what's the thing that's most dear to us? And that's who we are. The spirit soul. So Krishna discloses confidential knowledge in chapter 2. Who we really are. And then there's more confidential. What's more confidential than knowing who you are? It's knowing the distinction between the individual soul and the supreme soul. So Krishna discloses that in chapter 4 and other places. Atma and Paramatma. The living entity and the supreme living entity. And most confidential is chapter 9. It's the relationship of love between the individual soul and the supreme soul through the medium of devotional service. Ananyas chintayanto mam. Or, no, it's a different. What was the phrase?
Ananya
cheta satatam. I just want to keep her connected. Yo mam smarati. Nitya Shaha. So, devotional service. Now, Krishna's, he's give his proclamation. This is the most confidential knowledge. And what's the first topic that Krishna speaks about to introduce this most confidential knowledge? That's not what you would expect. He starts speaking about his relationship with matter. Now, why does he do that? That's like what's this is? Let's get up there. Let's get to the devotional service stuff. But to get to the devotional service stuff, you have to understand what this place is, and what's this place's relationship with Krishna. Because otherwise, you can't engage in devotional service properly. It's at best, it's mechanical or ritualistic, but it's not with an understanding of what that tree out there and the bird jumping around the tree and the wind blowing and all the people here and, you know, all of our individuality, what does that have to do with Krishna? It has everything to do with Krishna, and he explains what the relationship of himself to creation or the cosmos or his energies. And the way he describes it is mystical, or I call it Upanishadic double talk. Krishna says, I'm within everything, but I'm outside of everything. Come on. What do you mean? Everything is within me and everything is outside of me. Behold my mystic opulence. And then he gives a metaphor to help understand what he means by that. What he means by that, the metaphor is, as the mighty wind blows within the vastness of space, so similarly everything rests in me. As the mighty wind blows. So when the mighty wind blows, and the tree branches are moving, and the bird is jumping from branches, all those things are happening. What's happening to space? Is space moving or not moving? Space isn't moving. The wind can be moving. The wind can be still. Space, because it's more subtle and thus air is within it, may be moving or not moving. Space is unaffected. Krishna is unaffected. It's his energies. They're situated in him. But as his energy moves, he's unchanged. Say it again. His energies are moving. He's unchanged. It's all by under his direction. It's all part of him. It's within him, as the air is within space. But Krishna is unchanging, although the matter is changing, and the matter is inseparable from him. It's achinta bheda abheda tattva. That's it's an emphasis on the achintya part. It's inconceivable. Don't try to figure it out that way. Because you'll never understand it. But you can understand it through devotion. By engaging that which is Krishna's energy in the service unto the proprietor of his energy, Krishna. And then it can be understood. Not only understood, it can be realized. That you can directly perceive the self and the proper situation of all of Krishna's energies in all circumstances through the medium of devotional service. So that's the second section. And it's very deep. But devotional service is deep. It's not superficial, it's very deep. Devotional service is very, it's the essence of the living entity's identity. We're servants of Krishna. So then, the next section, Krishna describes those who are his devotees and those that aren't his devotees. Ultimately, everyone's Krishna's devotee, they just don't know it, or they've forgotten it. Constitutionally, we're all servants of Krishna. So the distinction Krishna gives, first he casts a very broad net, or a very broad description of who is his devotee. And in essence, anyone who has, quote, some conception of the Supreme, even if it's a mistaken conception, some conception of the Supreme. He begins by saying they're fools that deride him. So he doesn't have a lot of nice things to say about those persons. But there are those that have a different conceptions, and he gives basically three, and then he expands on those three. Ekatvena, Pratakdvena Bahuda, and Vishvato Mukham. What's that? Ekatvena, it's impersonalists. Ekatvena, those that... these are all indirect, but Krishna with the broad net says, they're also my devotees. So they're monists, and they worship themselves as supreme. Really? They worship themselves as supreme? Poor supreme. But aham brahmasmi, I am Brahman, which is true, I am Brahman, but there's para-Brahman. But at least there's some conception of supreme, and I am that. Yeah, tatvamasi, I am that. So they're monists. In this broad net, Krishna says, they're also my devotees. That's indirect and with the wrong conception. But there's some conception. Well, it's a wrong conception. There's some conception. And then Vishvata Mukham, Vishvato Mukham, which Vishva. Vishva means?
Universe.
Vishva means the universe. Vishva Rupa is the universal form. So Vishva, Vishvato Mukham, those who worship my universal form. So there's the monists, there's those that worship the universal form, going up the ladder a little, and now Bahuda, Pataktvena, Bahuda, those that worship the many, the demigod worshippers. Little above the, so Ekatvena and Vishvato Mukham and Pratakdvena Bahuda. The monists, the worshippers of the impersonal form, the worshippers of the demigods. So there's some conception of the supreme in each of those. It's just misdirected in Krishna's explanation or presentation. So what he wants to get to the devotional service, this very or most confidential understanding, one has to have the right conception of the Supreme. You have to have the right conception of who you are. You have to have the right conception of what matter is and the right conception of the Supreme. And it's not like you just put it all in a blender and turn it on high speed and get a smoothie and it's all one. They're distinct entities. And we have a right conception, then what flows is devotional service. And that's what's going to come in chapter 10 also. When one understands that Krishna is the source of everything, and I'm of this category of everything, and matter is another category, but Krishna is the source of everything, then you engage in devotional service. At least if you're honest. And if you're dishonest, then you can do something else. But the right understanding is there. It naturally follows. So, now Krishna describes that process of devotional service. And it's a very, very pleasant description. It's very simple. Take a leaf. Having trouble finding a leaf somewhere? It's springtime, there's lots of leaves, or a fruit. They're not ripe yet, but you can go to the market and get a fruit, or a flower, or some water, and offer that to Krishna with love. And Krishna accepts. That's devotional service. With love, it's devotional service. Without any expectation. Just, Krishna, please. It's not that Krishna needs some water or he needs a leaf. It's the relationship and the offering of love and the acceptance by Krishna. Now we're going to get to that's the most confidential, but the most confidential of the most confidential is How does Krishna feel? That's really confidential. When someone offers to him, when you offer to him, what does Krishna feel? He's neutral, but he reciprocates with the love. Because going back, he's like the sky within which the mighty wind is blowing. He's neutral. He's not partial to anyone. But those who approach him with love, he reciprocates with that love. So it looks like he's partial. And in one sense, he's partial. But in from Krishna's position, it's just reciprocation of love. As they surrender unto me, I reward them accordingly. So, supposing we're Kamsa, I kill Krishna. He's my enemy. So what does Krishna feel? Oh yeah, you want to be my enemy? That's not what Krishna does. Krishna says, okay, you'd like me to be your enemy? All right, I'll be your enemy. He's not inimical. He's reciprocating with the Kamsa Bhav, his disposition. And then there's Sudama, who thinks, oh, Krishna's my dearmost friend. I don't want to ask anything from Krishna. So what does Krishna feel? Oh, I know what's in Sudama's heart. I'll give that to Sudama without him even asking. That's Krishna. With love, with such love, Krishna reciprocates the love of his devotee. So it looks like, you know, Krishna's nice to Sudama and mean to Kamsa. It's not, that's the appearance, but it's Krishna simply reciprocating with the mood of how someone regards him. Now, one of the apparent contradictions in all of this is, what about when the devotee does something bad? What if the devotee does something really bad? But they're a devotee. What does it mean to be a devotee? Who knows the verse? Apichat sudharacharo bhajate mam ananya bhak. That's good enough. That's good enough. We focus on the ananya bhakti. What does anya mean? Anya means other. And ananya means no other. They are not devoted to anything other than Krishna. What's the verse from chapter 8? Ananya cheta satatam yomam smarati. What's the rest? Nityashah. That's ananya bhakti. So Krishna, at the, towards the end of chapter 9, is saying in other words what he said at the end of chapter 8. Someone that has that qualification, they always think of me and they're engaged in my devotional service. Always. So here comes this tidal wave. And they get covered. In that covered condition, they do something very bad. Prabhupada gives the example like the tide. Does Lake Michigan have a tide, comes and goes? No. Not big enough. Okay. But the ocean, it comes high tide and low tide. At high tide and low tide. And you know, very consistently, it comes up to a certain point and stops. And then, because of the movements of the moon, it goes back. And then comes and it goes. So supposing that normal, you know, range of high tide, low tide, changes with a tsunami. Big wall of water comes and covers the land. Smashes everything in sight. And then when the tsunami recedes, it's back to high tide, low tide, high tide, low tide. because that's the ananya. So similarly with a devotee, if they're ananya bhaktas, they're always engaged in, they may have their highs and lows, they may have their more intense or more relaxed or like less intense stages of expressions of devotion, maybe varieties of moods of devotion, but they're always in the mood of devotion. If such a person does something very bad, Krishna says, this person is saintly. That's how I see them. And that means that's how we should see them. It doesn't mean, oh, I can do whatever I like and I'm saintly. But if the ananya bhakti is the consistent disposition of a devotee, we should see that person as a saintly person. Even if the tsunami-like or the circumstantial situation arises and some bad behavior is there. So, then Krishna says that he personally intervenes in that individual's life and corrects the situation. And he concludes, how does he conclude chapter 9? What's the final verse of chapter 9? It's like, this is really the middle. Because there's 18 chapters in Bhagavad Gita. What's 18 divided by 2? 18 divided by 2. You don't know. What's 18 divided by 2?
9.
Okay. You knew you were just teasing us. So, halfway through Bhagavad Gita is the last verse of chapter 9. The last verse of chapter 9 is Manmana Bhava Mad Bhakto Madhyaji Mam Namaskuru. So that's the most confidential part of the most confidential part of Bhagavad Gita. Four things. What are those four things? Manmana means think of Krishna. Bhavamad Bhakto means become my devotee. Madhyaji means worship me. Yaja, yaja. Yaja means worship. Madhyaji. Mam Namaskuru. Offer your obeisances unto Krishna. Just four things. Is it difficult? A leaf? And you offer to Krishna with love? And Krishna reciprocates? He accepts it? A leaf? With love, he accepts it. Or a flower, or a fruit, or your life. And Krishna accepts you. Wow. This is the most... It's a very personal acceptance. It's not, okay, put him over in that box or in that category and stand in that line for a while. It's very personal. Very direct and personal. That's Krishna. Okay. So we're ready for the power and the lights and action. Here we go. Sounds like we're taking off. Okay. And I hope the sound works.
Chapter 9, The Most Confidential Knowledge.
Okay, so this is presented in three sections. We'll start with the Mahima section.
The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "My dear Arjuna, because you are never envious of me, I shall impart to you this most confidential knowledge and realization,
volume, control,
knowing which you shall be relieved of the miseries of material existence."
Yeah. have this. Let me have this. I'm going to go back to the beginning.
Personality of Godhead said, "My dear Arjuna, because you are never envious of me, I shall impart to you this most confidential knowledge and realization, knowing which you shall be relieved of the miseries of material existence. This knowledge is the king of education, the most secret of all secrets. It is the purest knowledge. Because it gives direct perception of the self by realization, it is the perfection of religion. It is everlasting and it is joyfully performed.
So that's quite a promise Krishna's giving. He's going to give this most confidential knowledge that has all these wonderful qualities. And he's openly declaring it, although he's calling it most confidential. So the barriers, or that which prevents one from understanding the most confidential knowledge, is this quality of enviousness. It's just like if there are two persons that know each other very well, they have a very confidential relationship, they can have a conversation that you're hearing, and you don't understand any of it. Because they speak in such a way, they can understand each other very well, and as a third party, you don't have that confidential relationship, so you don't understand all of what they're communicating and expressing. So, that non-enviousness is the qualification for that confidential relationship. And preliminary also is being faithful. So here's what Krishna says.
Those who are not faithful in this devotional service cannot attain me, O conqueror of enemies. Therefore they return to the path of birth and death in this material world.
What's a classic example of one who achieves spiritual perfection with good association because of faith? Having the quality of faith along with good association. Narada Muni. So because of time, I'm not going to go, there's a whole Narada Muni section, but I'm not going to go there because of time. But it's a nice little detour of exemplifying this quality of faith. It's a nice section because it's such an important subject matter. We even attempted to contribute, but we won't. So that's the glories of what's in this chapter and the qualifications to receive it. Now Krishna is going to describe his relationship with the cosmos, or the relationship with his energies.
Krishna's unmanifested form pervades everything, but Krishna himself remains detached from matter. Material nature, working under his direction, produces all moving and non-moving beings.
By me, in my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. All beings are in me, I am not in them. And yet everything that is created does not rest in me. Behold my mystic opulence.
Now what does this mean that everything rests upon Krishna? If we don't understand it properly, we may think it's something like Charles Atlas, and he's lifting the globe. Whoops.
Behold my mystic opulence. Although I am the maintainer of all living entities, and although I am everywhere, I am not a part of this cosmic manifestation. For myself is the very source of creation. Understand that as the mighty wind blowing everywhere, rests always in the sky. All created beings rest in me. O son of Kunti, at the end of the millennium, all material manifestations enter into my nature. And at the beginning of another millennium, by my potency, I create them again. The whole cosmic order is under me. Under my will, it is automatically manifested again and again. And under my will, it is annihilated at the end. O Dhananjaya, all this work cannot bind me. I am ever detached from all these material activities, seated as though neutral. Material nature, which is one of my energies, is working under my direction, O son of Kunti, producing all moving and non-moving beings.
Foolish persons do not know Krishna's transcendental and supreme nature. They consider the human-like form of the Lord to be material. The great souls, however, are undiluted.
So he starts with the faithless, and the faithless have a wrong conception, and they deride Krishna, or speak of Krishna as an ordinary person with a material form. So then Krishna goes into describing, in contrast to those that are Mahatmas, great souls, and how the great souls understand Krishna's form.
Fools deride me when I descend in the human form. They do not know my transcendental nature as the supreme lord of all that be. Those who are thus bewildered are attracted by demonic and atheistic views. In that deluded condition, their hopes for liberation, their fruitive activities, and their culture of knowledge are all defeated. O son of Pritha, those who are not deluded, the great souls, are under the protection of the divine nature. They are fully engaged in devotional service because they know me as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, original and inexhaustible. Always chanting my glories, endeavoring with great determination, bowing down before me, great souls perpetually worship me with devotion.
So Krishna just made the connection between the beginning part of chapter 9, where he's describing his relationship with creation and his energies. Those that understand that about Krishna, they engage themselves in devotional service in this way, in this, as the Mahatmas do. They're under the protection of the divine nature, they're fixed in their determination and so forth. Perpetually they worship Krishna with devotion. So then there are those that are not in that position of understanding Krishna with the right conception as the source of everything. And so they have other types of worship. And Krishna describes that next.
Others who engage in sacrifice by the cultivation of knowledge worship the Supreme Lord as the one without a second, diverse in many, and in the universal form. But it is I who am the ritual, I the sacrifice, the offering to the ancestors, the healing herb, transcendental chant, I am the butter and the fire and the offering. I am the father of this universe, the mother, the support and the grandson. I am the object of knowledge, the purifier and the silver bowl. I am also the reef, the sama and the yajurvedas. I am the goal. The sustainer, the master, the witness. The abode, the refuge, and the most dear friend. I am the creation and the annihilation, the basis of everything, the resting place, and the eternal seed. O Arjuna, I give heat, and I withhold and send forth the rain. I am immortality, and I am also death personified. Both spirit and matter are in me.
Different worshippers reach different goals. Men who want to attain the heavenly planets worship the demigods, and then take birth among them to enjoy godly delights. But such men, after exhausting their pious credits, return to earth. Men who worship ancestors go to the planets of the ancestors, and those who worship ghosts become ghosts. But one who worships Krishna with exclusive devotion goes to him forever.
So Krishna is making a distinction. Previously it was the broad net, and now it's a more tight picture of things, that according to different conceptions of what is supreme, and thereby worship, there are different destinations. It's not this other idea, whatever you worship, all roads lead to Rome. Yatamatatopat, whatever you do is fine, it's all the same, it's all one. It's directly not what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. There are different destinations according to the conception of what is supreme.
Those who study the Vedas and drink the soma juice, seeking the heavenly planets, worship me indirectly. Purified of sinful reactions, they take birth on the pious heavenly planet of Buddha, where they enjoy godly delights. When they have thus enjoyed vast heavenly sense pleasure, and the results of their pious activities are exhausted, they return to this mortal planet again. Thus, those who seek sense enjoyment by adhering to the principles of the three Vedas achieve only repeated birth and death. But those who always worship me with exclusive devotion, meditating on my transcendental form, to them I carry what they lack. And I preserve what they have. Those who are devotees of other gods and who worship them with faith, actually worship only me, O son of Kunti. But they do so in a wrong way.
So here's the example of faith. As by pouring water on the root of a tree, the water goes to all the different parts of the tree. So similarly, if one finds the root of all existence and places all of one's effort of worship there, the root of all existence, automatically all the devatas are receiving benefit just by worshiping Krishna. So those that don't do that, pour some water in this leaf and that leaf and the other leaf and this twig and that branch, and it's wrongly done, or avidhi, purvakam. Vid means to know, and avid or avidhi is without proper knowledge. They're making a mistake. Misguided, misdirected worship. So before it was the broad net, and now it's the narrow net. They're devotees, but it's wrongly done. Because Krishna is everything.
I am the only enjoyer and master of all sacrifices. Therefore, those who do not recognize my true transcendental nature fall down. Those who worship the demigods will take birth among the demigods. Those who worship the ancestors go to the ancestors. Those who worship ghosts and spirits will take birth among such beings. Those who worship me will live with me. Worship.
therefore, those who worship me will live.
What happened?
Chapter 9.
Okay, we'll go to here. This is the last section.
Whatever Krishna's devotee does, he eats, offers, or gives away in charity, he does as an offering unto the Lord. Krishna reciprocates by carrying what his devotee lacks and preserving what he has. By taking shelter of Krishna, even low-born persons can attain supreme destination.
If one offers me with love and devotion a leaf, a flower, fruit, or water, I will accept it. Whatever you eat, whatever you offer or give away, and whatever austerities you perform, do that, O son of Kunti, as an offering to me. In this way, you will be free from bondage to work and its auspicious and inauspicious results. With your mind fixed on me and this principle of renunciation, you will be liberated. Come to me. I envy no one, nor am I partial to anyone. I am equal to all. But whoever renders service unto me in devotion is a friend, is in me, and I am also a friend to him. Even if one commits the most abominable action, if he is engaged in devotional service, he is to be considered saintly because he is properly situated in his determination. He quickly becomes righteous and attains lasting peace. O son of Kunti, declare it boldly that my devotee never perishes. O son of Pritha, those who take shelter in me, though they be of low birth, women, Vaishyas, virtues, Sudras, workers, can attain the supreme destination. How much more this is so with the righteous Brahmanas, the devotees, and the saintly kings. Therefore, having come to this temporary, miserable world, engage in loving service unto me. Engage your mind, always thinking of me. Become my devotee. Offer obeisances to me and worship me. Being completely absorbed in me, surely you will come to me.
Krishna and Arjuna going to the abode of Mahavishnu. So there's the end of chapter 9.
way over schedule. So let's let's talk to have our tea.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you all very much.
Jai.